Welcome, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. We got a packed show today. Whole week has been busy on you. It's been a very busy week, and
we're halfway through it. This doesn't make any sense that it's Wednesday.
No, it's a Wednesday that feels like Friday. We dropped 60 degrees in temperature in 24 hours. It's bedlam here. Today, I'm really excited to be joined by Milwaukee historian, racial justice researcher, and a good friend of mine, Reggie Jackson. He's going to be joining us at the bottom of the hour. We're going to talk about the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. And Reggie's been doing some research about that. And I think, again, urban or rural, this is something we hear about all the time. It's good to take a pause and dive into the data a bit to try to understand what's actually going on there. The interesting thing, we incarcerate so many people for nonviolent drug offenses. So over-incarceration of nonviolent addiction, drug offenses, et cetera, it's not a black-white issue. It ain't an urban-rural issue. It's an everybody issue, because the only folks that I know that get away with stuff are rich people and politicians. But today, I want to kick this off with a discussion about medical misinformation and the people that make money selling this garbage. I've wondered for a long time whether we're talking about political lies, which can eventually take lives and certainly did on January 6th. But the lies being peddled, like people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the Florida Surgeon General Ladapo, spent a long time thinking about why is it that these people are doing these things? Well, the Washington Post, based on some research done by ProPublica, a review of hundreds of tax records, have answered the question Anya, if I asked you, why would someone peddle in lies? Why do people do bad things? What potential answer pops to mind, like front of mind?
Money.
Yeah.
Yeah, money mostly.
Money.
Or just like, I don't know, I think some people do make bad decisions for fun, but mostly money.
Mostly yeah. Money. Money and power, money and influence.
Yeah.
Money
yeah.
and ego, money, greed, power. I mean, all of it, right?
Yeah, those things.
Turns out that's exactly what we've got going on here. But before we get into some of the details, this Washington Post article coming from February 22nd, other coverage from February 21st, Lauren Weber. Let's listen to some of the nonsense that the Florida Surgeon General had to say. We're going to listen to that Ladapo cut. Now, it might be a little hard to hear, so Anya's going to crank it up and we'll read a little bit of it back.
Yeah, we got some crunchy coverage from a Zoom feed onto Facebook from the Florida Health Department. Here we go.
This morning, in terms of our colleagues here, all physicians and excellent scientists at universities around the country, concentrated in the state of California this morning. I'm very happy. I want to join Governor DeSantis in thanking you for joining us this morning. You've all been individuals who have I found to be of great benefit in terms of my knowledge and understanding during the pandemic, and it's great. We also happen to be friends, so that's been great too. And that is inexplicable in terms of thinking about data and thinking about common sense. So I want to start by identifying something that is really a cornerstone. From my perspective to discussions about the decisions that were recently made. And I'm going to quote the director of the CDC in that. So her statement, this is a piece of her statement. She said that vaccination remains the best protection against COVID-19 related hospitalization and death. And that statement, certainly it sounds good. It feels good. It seems like something that absolutely should be true. But there's a big problem. And that big problem is that the elephant is not in the room.
Huh? What?
And she has made this statement without a drop of clinical trial data about these products that were just approved that say anything about their effectiveness or their safety in
Liar.
Human beings. And we are just at a point where we have the director of the CDC making very clear statements in the complete absence of data, and somehow many people believing that that is true. So at this point, I'd like to start by turning to.
I'd like to start by saying someone's right here and someone's wrong.
And some elephant is not here
in the room. I don't even like that tortured metaphor.
What you couldn't hear him say is immediately after he says the elephant is not in the room, that elephant being data. And then he goes on to say that there's no data about vaccines. And that's a lie, right, Meg? That's gotta be a lie.
That is a lie. The component parts, the underlying inputs, if you will, into the COVID-19 vaccine have been around for a very long time. It's why the vaccine was so able to be quickly developed. Millions, tens and hundreds of millions of people have received multiple doses of the COVID vaccine. What is this guy talking about? These two things, what the Florida Surgeon General, and he's, I love he talks about all these great physicians and scientists that help with my knowledge and understanding. If I'm the Florida Surgeon General, I might want to do some of my own read the actual research papers. You would assume that a Surgeon General has the technical and scientific expertise to educate himself and not take the word of other doctors and scientists who may have, you know, ego, money, influence, power that's motivating them. He quotes someone from the CDC saying vaccines are the best protection against COVID-19 hospitalization and death. I'm sorry, sir. What is your contrary evidence? There isn't any. This man has been a danger since the moment he stepped into office as appointed by Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida. And his dangerousness isn't just confined to the world of COVID. He's now defying what has been some of the most long-standing accepted medical evidence. He you know, in that clip, Anya, right, he's talking about, well, we need to look at this other data, this other evidence. But the story reported by the Washington Post has to do with the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. Okay, so there has been an increasing incidence of measles outbreaks. This had started to trend up before the COVID-19 hysteria. And in a Florida elementary school, there was a measles outbreak. And it's highly, measles is really contagious. And if you don't have the measles vaccine, the MMR vaccine, and you're exposed to it, it's something like you have a 96% chance of contracting it. Here it is from the Washington Post. Because measles virus particles can linger in the air and on surfaces for up to 2 hours after an infected person leaves the area. Up to 90% of people without immunity will contract measles if exposed. However, if you've already been infected or you've been vaccinated, in other words, you have immunity, 98% of people are protected and won't contract measles. That's how effective that vaccine is. That's how contagious it is if you do not have that immunity. And so in response to this measles outbreak in a Florida elementary school, which places the teachers, the staff, and every single kid at risk of death, instead of telling parents, if your child test positive for measles or is presenting with measles symptoms, you need to keep your child home for 21 days. That has been the longstanding scientific and medical consensus for a very long time. He just sent a letter to all the parents at this school that said, basically, do whatever you want. Just make whatever choice you think works for you. Ladapo said the state health department, quote, is deferring to parents or guardians to make decisions about school attendance, end quote. And the reason it's 21 days is that scientists and immunologists and virologists know that that is the incubation period for measles. So I ask you, we can have a discussion, and we will, not just today, but repeatedly on the Maggie Dawn Show, about this idea of the individual right that places other people's lives at risk. When those two values come together and clash, we here in the United States, we value individual choice in some areas. And even in those places where we really value individual choice, there are times when it comes into conflict with what is best for all of us, especially as it relates to these sorts of infectious diseases and viruses. Here in the state of Florida, it doesn't matter if the Surgeon General's advice will kill your child. We're going to preference the state of Florida. Surgeon General Ladapo is going to preference individual rights over the risk of death posed to every staff member, teacher, and other student in that school and everyone that they interact with. That ain't good medicine. It ain't good public policy. I'm Maggie Dawn. Keep it locked. We'll be back after these important messages here on the Civic Media Radio Network if you'd like to join us. 855-75-CIVIC. It's a brand new Maggie Dawn show. We got a brand new number. That's 855-75-4842. Back with more in a moment. Shakira's talking about some other guy. He said, Florida Surgeon General Ladapo said some nonsense. Nonsense. We've been talking about the profiteering that is the true motivation, the ego stroking, the power accumulation, the influence peddling that is truly the thing that is behind all of these folks that are spewing this medical misinformation. Can you really tell me that if Surgeon General Ladapo was not willing to trumpet all of this garbage, that Ron DeSantis would have appointed him to be Surgeon General? Heck no! He'd still be some guy that none of us would have heard of. And at least in that instance, he wouldn't be threatening the lives of Florida children and Florida residents and taxpayers. So we've been talking about this because there's a measles outbreak in a Florida elementary school. And in response to this, the Surgeon General said, parents, don't worry about it. Don't keep your kids home for 21 days, the known incubation period for measles. Don't do that. Just, make your own decisions. Who cares about how it affects other people? Do police pull people over if they're driving 100 miles an hour? Well, it's my choice. I'll just drive 100 miles an hour. Who cares? If I crash, it doesn't matter. I can drive over. No! Paul Offit, a pediatric infectious diseases expert at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, said Ladapo's failure to urge vaccination endangers children. Quote, is he trying to prove that measles isn't a contagious disease when the data are clear that it is the most contagious vaccine-preventable disease. He's going to kill people. And here's what can happen if you contract measles because, you know, I don't really want to believe scientific consensus. About 1 in 5 unvaccinated people in the United States who contract measles is hospitalized. As many as 1 out of 20 children who contract measles develop pneumonia, which is the most common cause of death for measles in young children. About 1 child out of every 1,000 with measles will develop swelling of the brain that can lead to convulsions and leave the child deaf or with an intellectual disability. For unvaccinated babies who contract measles, 1 in 600 can develop a fatal neurological complication that can lie dormant for years. Why? Why trade in this? Why trade in these lies? Why create uncertainty, if you even want to call it that, when there is none? Greed, power, profit. It sickens me in the extreme. Joanne, good to hear from you. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. How are you this afternoon?
Oh, amazed as usual by your insightful comments. I would add celebrity to that list. You were talking about power and all of that and greed. There's nothing as appealing to some people as reading something that's contrarian, that's a conspiracy theory or whatever. And Truth Social, even though a lot of people thought it wouldn't take off as a social media platform, that's accumulated a lot of money for a lot of people in getting that word out and making people small celebrities with their their approaches to these very common and very worthwhile medical procedures. I mean, everyday medical procedure, getting a vaccine for your kid for measles, that's made a problem, and it's made to be something that these folks are fighting against as, like tilting at windmills.
Sorry, we're running out of time, Joanne. I'm so sorry. Yeah, they're tilting at windmills. And when I said ego, that's exactly what I mean. They want the fame. They want the fortune. They want the influence. They want the power. After these important messages, we're going to bring on my friend Reggie Jackson. But at the end of the show, you're going to want to keep it locked because I'm going to come back to this idea and I'm going to give you the numbers. I'm going to tell you the millions that have been pouring in to these purveyors of bullpucky when it comes to public health and the life of you and your children, your friends, and family. Keep it locked. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. You got Reggie Jackson coming up, Milwaukee historian, racial justice researcher, and good friend of both myself, Mr. Earl Ingram, and the Civic Media Radio Network. Join us, 855-75-CIVIC. Welcome back, everybody. Just a quick little moment of pause there. If you were on the lines, Karina, I saw you there, my friend. Sorry I couldn't get to you. 855-75-CIVIC. Yeah, we've been setting the stage for a discussion about how much money folks are making. And I'll just put this out there. Mr. Ladapo, after he leaves the Surgeon General's office, will probably make millions. Because he's proved himself willing to say basically damn near anything. This is the thing that, as a lawyer, troubles me. as an economist, as a researcher, as a public servant. Because folks look to people like Surgeon General Ladapo. They look to elected leaders. We deride them. We criticize them, right? All the time. And we should do that. That's important. But folks like lawyers and doctors and elected officials that have platforms and that are supposed to be working for the best interests of every single one of us, no matter where we come from, no matter who we are adopting positions that run contrary to all of their training and the oaths that they take, the public's trust that is given them. It is a betrayal of all of those things. So when I look at a lawyer like Rudy Giuliani or Sidney Powell or Kenneth Cheeseborough or any of these folks or doctors like Mr. Ladapo, the Surgeon General of Florida, what I see is one of the gravest, most serious betrayals of public trust that we have seen in modern history. When we come back, Reggie Jackson's going to be on the line with us. We're going to dig into the school-to-prison pipeline here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Again, if you want to join us, say hi to Mr. Jackson, 855-75-CIVIC. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Wind is blowing today all across the state of Wisconsin. Brr, it is cold outside, and I might blow hot air, but my next guest certainly does not. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join our conversation this chilly Wednesday afternoon, 855-75-CIVIC. I'm joined now by my friend, researcher, Milwaukee historian, Renaissance man, Reggie Jackson. It's so good to see you, Reggie. Happy Black History Month.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Maggie. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, I can't wait to do this on the regular. I think I'm going to call it like on the regular with Reggie, just because that works. You have taught me so much. You've helped me explore places of my own ignorance. And when we had lunch just a couple of weeks ago, this topic about the school to prison pipeline, I was so excited to hear that this was your most recent reinvigorated area of research. What brought you to, what made you think, I need to go take a look at this? Because this line, the school to prison pipeline, has been sort of accepted gospel for so many years. Everybody's heard the saying. What made you say, I got to take a look at this?
Well, part of it is that I'm bothered that people continually say, even though it's not true, that, you know, the number of prisons that states build are based on third grade test scores. That's a fallacy, a myth that's been out there. That's been repeated by so many people that it's almost like it's gospel now.
Tell
it's
people,
never been true.
Sorry to interrupt. Tell people what's meant by that when they say based on third grade test scores, meaning if folks aren't doing well in the standardized tests, they build more prisons.
Yeah, that's the you know, the narrative that's been out there for probably a good 20 years.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, they look at third grade test scores and they determine that particular group of students who are doing poorly on those tests in third grade are probably going to end up in prison at some point, and therefore they know how many prisons they need to build, how many beds they need in prisons. But it's just simply not true.
Yeah, I don't know
each
about
state,
yeah, yeah, I don't
each
know about
state has their own methodology for determining how many prisons they build, and none of them, from the research I've done, have used test scores.
Yeah. So the whole premise of the saying is basically baloney, is what you're telling us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like so many other things. It's repeated so many times that people begin to believe that it's true. Like, well, I heard this person say it, and I heard that person say it. You know, someone had the audacity to tell me, Reggie, I've heard 100 people say that it has to be true. I'm like, dude.
That's
there's
not the way
a
it
whole
works.
Lot more than 100 people living in this. 340 million people living in this country. Just because 100 people say something doesn't make it, you know, the gospel. It just doesn't work like that. And, you know, I'm a data person, man.
Yes.
So, I looked into it. And I believe that, you know, our prisons are full of mostly poor people.
Yes.
And mostly people that don't have a lot of education. I actually looked up the data, the most recent data from the Department of Corrections in Wisconsin. So if you look at all people that are in prison in Wisconsin's prisons today, 3% of them have less than a ninth grade as their highest grade completed in school. 24% went from either ninth or 12th grade as their highest grade completed. 48% highest educational attainment is a GED or high school education,
wow.
High school equivalency diploma. So there's a lot of people who don't have a lot of education. And those numbers are even worse when you look at, you know, different demographic groups. So among Black men that are in prison in Wisconsin, the number who have less than a ninth grade education, 2.8% of Black men in prison have that level of education. 34% are at ninth to 12th grade as their highest level of attainment, and 45% GED or high school equivalency diploma. So
wow,
it's pretty bad. It's pretty indicative of the fact that our prisons are going to continue to be, you know, filled mostly with people who are poorly educated. The numbers for people who have, you know, some level of college are very, very low. And I look at it, you know, when people talk about the school to prison pipeline, I say this to people all the time, that we just recently had a big report that came out, the National Report Card. So every year since 1970 in the U.S., schools around the country give students a standardized test called the NAEP test, yep. The National Assessment for Educational Progress Test, and they give it to multiple subjects. That test is given to 9-year-olds, 13-year-olds, and 17-year-olds in schools across the country. And the latest report from 2 years ago showed that there were significant declines in those test scores prior to COVID. So during COVID, because of what happened to the schools, you know, students didn't learn very much, and their test scores plummeted, you know, drastically during COVID. And so when you compare where we are as a nation, looking at our test as compared to other industrialized nations, we are one of the lowest on the planet. We are somewhere in the 20s when it comes to math and reading scores as compared to other industrialized nations. And so one of the things that I tell people, you have to dig a little bit deeper, Maggie, you have to look at how Black and brown kids are doing specifically. And the reason I say that is because they are today, a majority of the kids in our public schools are Black and brown kids. A majority of the babies in this country that are less than a year old are babies of color. So as we continue to move forward, this demographic shift that's taking place already is not going to change.
Right.
We're still going to have a lot of very young people in our schools that are their students of color, and the schools just don't do very well for those kids at all.
No, and the fact, when we look at, and I've had Princeton professor Catherine Eden on my show, we're going to bring her back in just a little bit over a month, I'm hopeful. What she talks about is the fact that when you look at voucher and charter systems, and you start talking about universal voucher systems, which is what candidate for Wisconsin Governor Tim Michaels, that was part of his platform, those actually, what they are, is effectively a way to segregate school systems, take public taxpayer dollars, fund religiously based education that can discriminate on any basis, reject any student. Whereas in the public schools, we take every child. We have a responsibility right. to every child, no matter what learning challenges they have, emotional challenges. And so, you know, we're seeing the impacts of this draining of money. And it's not just in the urban school systems. It's in rural school systems as well.
It's happening all over the country. You know, I'm a former teacher. I taught for 8 years in Milwaukee Public Schools as a special education teacher. And so I saw, you know, the impact that those types of things have. You know, one of the things that I've looked at quite closely over the years, I visit, you know, some of these schools that are getting, you know, vouchers. And I don't think people generally know, Maggie, that that money for the vouchers comes from the public school budgets.
Yep.
So the money is given to the public schools by the state, and then they have to take that money and give it to the parents of the kids to go to these private schools. And most of them are religious-based schools. And that that percentage is probably growing daily.
And it's one of the things that Professor Eden has pointed out is that similar mechanisms were used in the wake of school, in the wake of Brown v. Board, in the wake of desegregation. It was using taxpayer dollars to fund schools that racially discriminated, private schools. And so when someone says universal voucher or parental choice, basically it's saying, taxpayers, would you like to fund expensive private school education that a lot of rich people can already afford and already are paying the full load of that tuition? And the impacts are really accelerating. One of the papers you shared with me that I was reviewing to get ready for today, I just wanted to share the statistic because it was, it didn't surprise me, but it hit me because it was so devastatingly sad. And that is that Wisconsin has an incarceration rate of 663 persons per 100,000. And that places Wisconsin, basically, we lock up a higher percentage of our friends, neighbors, folks we see in our houses of worship, our family members. We lock up more, a greater percentage of people than almost any other democratic country on earth. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, thinking back to the point you were making about the school, you know, vouchers, you know, people, you know, we've all heard of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, but what we don't generally hear about or are taught about is what happened after the Brown decision.
Right.
First of all, it was a two-part decision where they said the schools were illegally, you know, segregated. And then the second part of the decision a year later was, you know, they gave the states where the schools were segregated the option of desegregating the schools with what they called all deliberate speed, which basically meant whenever you're ready to do it.
Right.
And they gave the states the choice to do it however they wanted to do it. So what most of the southern states did is they said, you know what, we're going to close our schools, or we're going to take the public school money and we're going to create private academies for the students to go to. But those private academies were for white kids only.
Only.
In fact, Maggie, just recently, I'm writing a book about the history of segregation. And so I'm telling my own kind of segregation story, moving from Mississippi to Milwaukee in the early 70s. And I looked at when the schools in Mississippi were actually integrated by the Supreme Court. It wasn't until 1970. And I was looking at the cases that led up to that decision. And one of the things that the state of Mississippi was arguing was that, you know, we had set up these, you know, these choice options for parents to send their kids to whatever schools they wanted to. This one particular county in Mississippi that was one of the cases that led to the Mississippi Supreme Court and eventually U.S. Supreme Court, this so-called choice program. You had this county, I don't remember the name of the county, but you had 170,000 black kids in that county who supposedly had a choice where they could go to school, but only 169 of them were able to get into the white school.
Less than 1%. 170,000.
Yeah. So, you know, doesn't sound like the choice program was really working. And the courts saw that and said, you know, this is just some malarkey. You know, this is not working. Integrate the schools immediately. And literally the schools were scrambling to figure out how to integrate, you know, at the last possible minute. So these things that people come up with, I tell people the thing I love most about history, Maggie, is that you can find that people just completely just copy and paste things that were done before.
Yep.
They don't come up with original thoughts. You know, these are not original, you know, mechanisms that people are using.
School choice.
Segregate. Yeah, segregate, because to me, it's a segregating opportunity. That's what it's really doing.
That's exactly
so
right.
School choice is not something that's new. You know, someone asked me recently, you know, was Milwaukee the first, you know, place to have, you know, school choice? I'm like, dude, you got to read some history books, man. This has been around a long time. Go back to the 50s, and these programs were set up specifically to give white parents a choice to send their kids to these private academies, because prior to Brown versus Board of Education, the only people that could send their kids to private schools were people who had money.
Right.
Regular, average, everyday Americans, you know, poor or even middle class Americans couldn't afford it. Yeah. That gave them the first opportunity to do so. They gave them money to do it. They didn't give the money to Black parents to send their kids to these schools because the schools maintain, you know, a segregated nature. They were all white schools.
Listen,
and so
we got to
do this stuff nowadays.
Yeah. Sorry, Reggie. I never want to interrupt you because I always want to hear what you're going to say next. You can hear what my friend and yours, Reggie Jackson, Milwaukee historian, racial justice researcher, is going to say after these important messages. If you want to join our conversation, ask a question. Don't be afraid to ask. Now's the time. We don't learn if we don't ask. 855-75-CIVIC. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I can't wait to hear what Reggie says next. Neither can you, so keep it locked. We'll be back with more in a moment. Got to know your history. Thank goodness Reggie Jackson is here to help us all with that history. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network, having a really important conversation about incarceration in this country, the school system, what vouchers and choice schools actually result in. If you want to join our conversation, 855-75-CIVIC. I wanted to share another statistic before we continue our conversation, because, again, I had an intuitive sense, but reading the actual data on some of this is really jarring. The prison population in the United States went up nearly 700% from 1972 until a peak in 2009. I just want us to think about that. From 1972 to 2009, the prison population in the United States went up 700%. By the way, that's prison. That isn't counting city and county jails. But since that time, since 2009, the overall prison population has actually decreased 25%. There's so much going on in this data. I'm so glad to hear, and I'm thankful for your attention to this subject matter. As you dug back in, Reggie, what really, was there anything that really shocked you, or did you have some kind of like spidey sense that things weren't as we might have been told?
Well, you know, I've been studying this topic pretty closely for a number of years, going back to the mid-1990s, when a good friend of mine told me that her brother was being sent to prison for 23 years, basically because he was the best friend of the biggest drug dealer in Milwaukee. And so I started to look into, you know, the role that the criminal justice system was playing in the lives of Black males in particular. And one of the things, you know, to go back to the data you mentioned, you know, imprisonment in the United States, you know, and state and federal prisons peaked in 2009. But for Black males, it peaked in 2002. And what people generally don't know is that 25% decrease overall, the decrease among Black males is like 39%. Almost 40% less Black men in prison today than at the peak back in 2002. So, you know, we talk about mass incarceration and disparities all the time. And I hear these conversations and I'm like, I often tell people, like, listen, look at the more recent data. What does the data tell you? And the data has shifted. The conversations need to shift. So for a number of years, we would hear people say that, you know, a Black male born in 1981 in this country has a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison during the course of his life. And that was because at that particular time in the 80s and the 90s, we were incarcerating people at such a high rate that that looked like that was going to be the case, you know, moving forward. But it shifted. And so the incarceration rate of Black men slowed down. And as a result, now they'll say, instead of 1 in 3 chance, now a Black male born in 2001 has 1 in 5 chance of ending up in prison, which is still way too high. And when you look at imprisonment across the planet, Maggie, there are about 11.5 million people in prisons on the planet Earth. We as Americans make up about 21% of all the people incarcerated on any given day.
Reggie, sorry, we got a couple cars. Do you mind if we have some folks ask
please.
You?
Yeah, all absolutely. Right. Yeah, what's sad about the fact that we incarcerate 21% of the people on the planet, we only make up about 4% of all the people on the planet Earth, the United States. So we're over-incarcerating at a rate that's just, you know, higher than any, pretty much any other country. You know, we talk about other countries and how horrible they are, but, you know, they pale in comparison to the incarceration rate that we have in this country.
Yeah, we got to take a look in the mirror. Susan, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. Say hello to Reggie. What's your question?
Hi, Reggie. Oh, well, I have a comment. Actually, in the late 90s, I worked at a corporation here in the Madison area, and one of the women was a reading teacher at the Madison School, and she said she was called by the Wisconsin Department of Corrections to find out how many Black/African-American young men were in her classroom because they were planning forward for bringing, you know, for the prison system to accommodate a certain percentage of those little boys. And I was astounded at that. And every time I think about it, it just tears me apart because you are setting people up for failure when they are, what, third grade. And I feel that we, as a American population, owe it to everyone to provide them with the best education and to keep them out of the tracks. And having relatives who are African-American descent, I feel as though they were being done a disservice as well. So,
yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Susan. It's, I don't know about you, I learned a lot since third grade. I learned a lot,
you know,
not the same person.
The sad thing is, you know, these assumptions that people make about these kids when they're in third grade, Maggie, assumptions about how the rest of their life is going to play out. You know, this isn't the first time we've done something like this. Back in the 1960s, in fact, when President Kennedy launched what he called the War on Juvenile Delinquents, there were assumptions made about young Black males that they were going to continue to grow at a rapid pace demographically, and that they were more than likely going to end up incarcerated. And so people started to create policies in terms of deciding how many prison beds were needed based on assuming that that demographic was going to end up incarcerated.
Yeah, it's pretty.
They had no idea that the numbers were wrong. And once they found out the numbers were wrong, they didn't change their policies. They just continued.
No, of course not. Why
giving states?
Let's not look at the data. Right. Let's not look at data-driven policy. And what you just said there, Reg, again, sorry to interrupt. We've got to take a couple important messages here shortly. But don't you worry, Reggie and I will be back after the top of the hour news. But what you just said there at the end is that there are a lot of people making a lot of money in the private prison system. We build them and we fill them. And a lot of people make a lot of money.
Not the private prison system, Maggie. The public prison system.
Both of them.
By far, majority of people in prison in this country are in, you know, state and federal run prisons.
Yeah, it's the industry in certain places.
Yeah, the percentage of people that are in private prisons is very, very low. It's never been very high. But I say that the criminal justice system, this apparatus that allows us to incarcerate, you know, close to 2 million people, there are over 2 million people who are employed by the system on any given day. You know, we look at police officers, probation, parole agents, judges, court clerks, prison guards.
We got to run. Everybody stay here. I'm sorry, Reggie. We will hear more from Reggie Jackson. We come back after the news at the top of the hour here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.